Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. My name is Paul Clark. I'm a member of the Asia Pacific Forum, and I want to welcome to tonight's discussion on China, Great Power Interrupted. Our two speakers tonight will be talking about China, Great Power Interrupted. You know, it's a very momentous time in China. We all know about the Olympics last year. It's the 60th anniversary of the People's Republic of China being founded. It's the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, although that's not being celebrated in China. But they also have other things that are developing. Among them, of course, is the economic downturn, which has been felt throughout the country as well as throughout the world. So our speakers will be speaking to these two issues. And our speakers are, on my far left, Aldous Cruz, who's a professor at University of San Francisco, and Robert Horrocks, who's at Matthews International Capital Management. So I'd like to introduce our very first speaker. And please remember to write down some questions and pass them up so you can ask great questions. Our first speaker is Dr. Robert Horrocks. He's the Chief Investment Officer for Matthews International Capital Management. Dr. Horrocks earned his PhD in Chinese Economic History from Leeds University and started his career with Carr Securities in Hong Kong. Subsequently, he oversaw investment strategies in Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, and again most recently returned to Hong Kong, where he was the head of research for an asset management firm. About a year ago, he came to Matthews, and he was a director of research and then was promoted about 9 or 10 months later to his current position as a chief investment officer, and he also co-manages the Asia Matthews Growth and Income Fund. So without any further ado, Dr. Horrocks.
It's always nice to get applause before I start speaking. I only hope it's the same after I finish. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. It's certainly quite a privilege. I've only been in San Francisco a little over a year, actually, almost a year to the day, and to get this sort of invitation is very nice indeed. Today's topic is China, a great power interrupted. I'm going to speak to the economics of that, and I guess I want to address a couple of questions here. To what extent was China actually ever a great economic power in the sense that we think about that today? And can it be a great economic power in the future? And really, what does that mean? And sometimes I think the idea that we... we use phrases like power in terms of economics, I think, is sometimes misplaced. So what does it mean for the U.S. as China gets richer? Also, I'm cognizant that we have two anniversaries this year. One is the 60th anniversary of the Communist Revolution and the Communists taking power in 1949. And I want to talk a little bit about China's economic development and what that anniversary meant in terms of that economic development. We also have the anniversary of 1989, the Tiananmen Square massacre. Now, what did that mean in the context of China's economic development? I've got a couple of answers that I want to start off with. First, I don't think China has ever really been a great economic power in the sense that we think of the U.S. today. Not economically, I don't think militarily either. I like to think of China as a country that has gone through a series of false starts throughout history. And only recently, and by recently I mean the last 20 or 30 years, is it finally getting the right sort of combination of political and economic structures to succeed. What does that mean in terms of some conventional wisdom that we hear about China as well? I think a lot of people have this idea that there is a trade-off between growth in China, that the political and social system is such that China can only be stable at fast paces of growth. I think this is also wrong. I think what you're seeing in general terms across the world is countries are getting more and more similar. China's taking a path that will make it far more recognizable to us in the West than it has been for maybe 20 or 30 years. And I think with that recognition will become a sense of familiarity and closer cooperation. That's my hope, anyway. First of all, just how important is China to the global economy? How important has it been in the recent past, in the last 10 years up to 2008? China probably contributed about 16% of growth in the global economy. According to IMF forecasts, in the years up to 2013, its contribution to global growth will be double that. Fully one-third of all the growth in economic activity that we see in the world will come from China alone. Now, what is the economic development of China over the years that has brought it to this stage? This chart shows us global shares of GDP going back to the year 100. That horizontal scale is not exactly to scale, but those numbers along the bottom will give you the years. China or Asia, which is predominantly China and India, is that blue section. To some extent, therefore, you could argue that China was a great economic power way back in the year 1000 or the year 1500, in the sense that it made up a huge proportion of global GDP. But think about what the global economy looked like then. It's largely agrarian. There's not a lot of manufacturing. There's not a great deal of trade, certainly not on the international scale that we see today. So what, in effect, did it mean to be a great economic power? It basically meant that you had a huge population. China never took off. It was never a great power in that sense. What you can see is you can see the European and American portion of this chart growing significantly during after about 1750 with the Industrial Revolution. China never had this. It certainly had the skills to manufacture. You can go to the observatory in the middle of Beijing and you see these fine astronomical instruments, not only very accurate at measuring the heavens, but also extremely ornate, built in the 1400s, the 1600s, the 1700s. And yet this never developed into a manufacturing system. It never developed beyond making such scientific instruments or trinkets for the emperor. It never developed the market structures like a limited liability company or a stock exchange or these other capital market structures that would allow it to develop in a capitalistic fashion. Everything, in fact, about advancement in China at this point is about your relationship to the imperial machine. The way to make money, to have a wealthy life in China, was to go through the imperial examinations, become a low-level bureaucrat, get yourself linked to the overall imperial bureaucracy, and live off live a rentier's kind of existence off the back of the peasantry. This all changed in the 19th century when the Westerners arrived with their gunships. And it became obvious to the Chinese that manufacturing, the ability to build machines, gave you military power, and that the Chinese government was very weak in relation to what they had always seen as inferior countries around the world, and countries that to some extent they'd only been vaguely familiar with. At this point, the imperial system collapses completely, and the political system falls apart, and China devolves into what is known as the warlord era. This is a particular fascination to me, although it's an era that is often seen by the Chinese themselves as one of great shame, one of total destruction of the country, but it wasn't really that. It was a destruction of a central authoritarian regime into a series of local regional powers. And yet within these regions, you could actually have quite thriving industries. You had a cotton mill industry growing up in Shanghai. You had light manufacturing industry and trade growing up in Guangdong. You had a free press, even under the warlord in the south of China. And I think China, ever since then, has been struggling with this idea of how do you put the imperial nationalist government back together and still maintain a vibrant economy. I think that's behind everything the Chinese government has tried to do. And in some ways, it swung too far to the extreme one way and then too far to the extreme the other. The birth of the Communist Party around about 1921 was actually from people who were really far better versed in liberal philosophy of the sort that Thomas Jefferson would have appreciated than they were in any of the writings of Lenin or Marx. The reason why the Chinese Communist Party became a Chinese Communist Party was because the Communist Party was the only anti-Western game in town. If you wanted to get rid of the imperialists, if you wanted to kick the British out of Hong Kong, you had to unite with somebody who had the military power to do that. That meant the Russians, the Communist International Movement, and that's where the nationalist movement in China and the communist movement joined forces. Here's the key point, then, from this piece of history. The Chinese Communist Party is not really a communist party. It's a party whose sole function is to try and maintain political stability between the regions, between the various provinces in China. It's not really that wedded to any kind of ideology, and we'll see that later on. What was the revolution in 1949 then? It was a nationalist revolution. It was kicking the Japanese out of China. The reason the communists won that battle was because the Nationalist Party was seen to be hand in glove with the Japanese. Again, 1949 was a nationalist revolution. What then was 1989? Well, to understand 1989, you have to understand what happened in the 40 years in between. In fact, I think not many people realize this. 1949, the Communist Party rescinded all laws in the country, and they put only one law for all intents and purposes in its place, and that was a family law, the marriage law, which allowed gave freedom to women, gave freedom to women to divorce. Pretty much every other decision then was in the hands of the Communist Party. But because of their inability to control everything at a low level, you actually had flourishing private enterprise in China until well into the 1950s, into 1957. This was actually a period of very strong economic growth. And it wasn't until you had the political struggles that were largely led by Mao and the Great Leap Forward, which was a tremendous attempt to bring China into a fully modern industrial society, that you had the government playing a really big role in the economy. Now, the Great Leap Forward was a huge undertaking and was a complete disaster. Why was it a complete disaster? Is because they instructed everybody to go and build a blast furnace in your back garden, literally a blast furnace in your back garden. Melt down all your pots and pans to provide metal that we'll use to build machinery in order to build the manufacturing capacity. Unfortunately, the metal was of such poor quality, the only things you could make with it were pots and pans. The blast furnaces were so inefficient that you could make about 30% of the pots and pans that you actually put in. So it was a huge exercise in destruction of wealth. Things started to liberalize only after a series of political struggles in the 1970s. After Mao, after the failure of the Great Leap Forward, was relegated to a more of a commemorative kind of figure, and his attempt to get back into power sparked off a series of political struggles. This was only ended in 1978 with the imprisonment of the so-called Gang of Four, which included Mao's wife. Now, what happened in 1978? The government stepped away again from the economy. It started giving small landholdings out to peasants. It liberalized the price system. It started to say, you make as much as you need to sell of your produce for the state procurement system. Anything outside of that, you can go and market it and sell it and keep the profits to yourself. Huge boost in productivity seen throughout the country. And since then, there's been a build-up of commercial law. Again, for the first time since 1949, the return of a legal system, the idea of a limited liability company for the first time really in China's history. And here again, a very strange thing, the special economic zones that were set up around the coast. and almost became like going back to the warlord era, where you had these flourishing areas of trade and manufacturing around the coastal areas of China. The crucial difference this time, you had a single government structure in charge in the center. So China had gone from 1920s to the 1980s, had wasted 60 years in political infighting to set up what basically, from my point of view, was roughly the same kind of economic infrastructure that it had then. What is the purpose of this experiment and this export-driven economy that we've seen in since the 1980s? The purpose is to gain knowledge, to gain expertise in commercial businesses, so that you can build the strength of the economy for the whole country. That's why this was only ever a phase in the development of China. The next step is to move everything inland. The special economic zones are no longer so starkly divided or portioned out from the country as they were. They now fit seamlessly with the inland communities. That's why in the stimulus package, when you build a bridge from Guangdong province to nowhere, it's actually you actually create economic activity at the other end. There are no bridges to nowhere in China in that sense. What the Communist Party now has embarked on is a huge attempt to grow the economy in the inland and to move out of the sphere of economic life. 1989, I think, was a reaction to this. 1989 was the first time that I was at university in China in Beijing in 87 to 88. My roommate was one of the protesters on the square. Now, he was facing for the first time the possibility of leaving university and not having an assigned job in the government sector, not having an assigned job in the state-owned enterprise. What's a state-owned enterprise? You would go in, you work for this company, it would provide you with clothing, accommodation, a hospital, a kindergarten for your kids, a middle school, everything, all within the factory. Now, the idea was that these would be shut down. People would be there to fend for themselves. There's a great deal of uncertainty around this time. I think a big reason for the demonstrations in 1989 was the perceived opportunities amongst the young people that this could throw up for them, coupled with great uncertainty of what was happening and a sudden realization that there were some forces within the senior levels of the Communist Party who were going to try and stop it from happening. Therefore, the very idealistic frame of mind of the movement, the goddess of democracy, this great sort of Statue of Liberty kind of figure that symbolized everything that they thought they could achieve. And yet, at the very high levels within the Communist Party, there seemed to be a massive argument going on between Zhao Ziyang and the reformists on the one hand and Li Peng and the conservatives on the other. Why is this important and why am I spending so much time talking about this? It's because when people worry about instability in China, it's often Tiananmen that they have in their mind. But Tiananmen was caused so much instability not because there was a massive groundswell of opinion, not because there were students off their own bat getting on into the streets, but because there was a factional split within the Communist Party. And there was definite involvement, I believe, at the very highest level of Communist Party leaders busing in workers, busing in students, busing in peasants from the countryside to come and protest. So when we think of large-scale political instability in China, you really have to look for some kind of split within the government. And this is where my earlier point about the Chinese Communist Party not really being communist is very, very important. You look at the ideology of the Communist Party, it's changed so much over the years. The original war cry, if you like, of the Communist Party was science and democracy. It said nothing about class struggle. That came later. Then with Mao, it was all about revolutionizing the peasantry because the peasantry was cheap, was a cheap army with which to attack the cities. Then with the reforms in 1978, it became socialism with Chinese characteristics. And socialism with Chinese characteristics basically meant free market economics with an authoritarian government. Then it became what's called the three represents. What's the three represents? The three represents means that to be a member of the Communist Party, you don't just have to be a worker or a peasant. You can be a capitalist. You can be a capitalist and be a member of the Communist Party. What kind of a Communist Party is that? They're actually very, very pragmatic and very flexible. And the divisions you had back in 1989 between the left and the right, between the conservatives and the reformers, are just not there anymore. The divisions now, because the Communist Party has become so inclusive and watered down in its ideology, the divisions are now about policy. So if fast growth is not by itself important for China, what is? You know, China is going to grow more slowly in the future than it has in the past. This is just the law of diminishing returns, and as a country gets wealthier, it will grow more slowly. It's going to happen. 11% growth will become 10%, will become 8%, will become 6%. Does that mean instability? It didn't mean instability for the US. It didn't mean instability for Europe. And it won't mean instability for China, because what they will do is they will build the welfare system. Right now, if you ask Chinese what is the number one thing on your mind, they will say healthcare spending. It's kind of the same as what everybody here is kind of concerned about. Buying a house, education. Why is healthcare spending so important? Well, you look at China, over 50% of spending on healthcare has to come out of the patient's pocket. You get seriously ill in China, you have to go cap in hand to your friends, your work colleagues, your neighbors to help you out. And they will, but it's not an ideal situation. And so what do? You save. You save huge amounts for a rainy day. What China will do is, in order to stimulate people to release some of those savings, to generate more domestic demand and consumption demand, they will start building this welfare system brick by brick. They started with unemployment insurance policies. They're going to spend about, I think it's about $150 billion on healthcare, which is already 8% of people's disposable income. So no, slow growth doesn't mean instability. Because that quality, the quality of that growth is going to change dramatically. What does it mean about the lifestyle of the ordinary Chinese, and how might that impact the way we think about our relationship with China? Well, this is the transformation that's happening in China right now. The back-breaking work of development has largely been completed in the urban cities. In fact, if you look at people's aspirations now, it's no longer the aspirations of the guy on the left who's just thinking, how on earth am I going to get this stuff up the hill? The aspirations of people are 25% of urban households want to buy a car within the next 3 years. 14% are hoping to buy a home within the next 3 years. What do you think most people say, and 20% of all households say the number one thing that they are going to spend on, their number one expenditure in the next 12 months, what do you think it is? Travel. People are wealthier now. They've got leisure time. They want to go and explore. They'll go and explore China, and they'll come here and explore the US. I was in a shopping mall just up in Petaluma when I first arrived. And as the shopping mall opened, the first announcement came in English, the second came in Mandarin Chinese, the third was in Spanish. How long before you start hearing Mandarin on the streets of San Francisco and people putting in bids for million-dollar homes in Marin? Not that long, I shouldn't wonder. What does this mean for the economic relationship between China and the U.S.? Well, really, we should be encouraged, because China's starting to look a lot more like what we would recognize as a familiar kind of society. I think it means that the U.S. has a lot to offer China. It has a lot to offer China, not only in terms of, obviously, tourism, obviously providing consumer goods or consumer services for them to enjoy, but there's going to be a huge infrastructure built in China in the coming years, and it's not the roads, it's not the railways, It's not the the air routes between cities. It's the virtual infrastructure that we all take for granted as a way of living more complex, more enjoyable, more fulfilling lives. It's the ability to take out a mortgage loan, to take out an auto loan, to use a credit card, to have a freer media, the internet, advertising, all these sorts of things that make building brands, all retail, all these sorts of things that make choices for people more varied, more interesting, makes more life more enjoyable. That's the growth in China. That's the infrastructure. And I think US does have some expertise to offer China. But it also, on a very basic level, this guy on the left, you can probably persuade him to be very envious of the US, to hate the US even, to convince him that everything bad in his life is due to the wicked Western society. It's very difficult to persuade the guy on the right of the same things. An old colleague of mine from Shanghai visited me just last week, and we had dinner together, which he paid for, which was very nice. And he said something very interesting. He's from Shanghai. He said, you know, lots of people, lots of Americans are coming to visit Shanghai, and they're always very impressed. They see it, how developed it is and how vibrant it is. But, you know, a lot of Chinese are now going to visit the U.S., and they come back slightly disappointed in a way. Their reaction is, well, we thought they were so much further ahead. We thought there was going to be so much of a difference between how the Americans live their lives and how we do. And there really isn't. Is democracy part of this? I don't think it is. I think what's on the major concerns of the average family is getting to that ideal, a house, a car, a couple of kids, a nice life, travel. Is democracy on the minds of the government? In a limited form, yes. But again, I don't think it's a big part of their concern. Big part of their concern is providing the welfare, the healthcare, all these essential functions of the state that they don't actually have there because they dismantled the state-run companies, but we take for granted. So is China a great power interrupted? I don't think it is a great power interrupted. I think it's a great power in economic terms, just taking its first few steps, just starting to build wealth. Is there a trade-off between growth and instability? Again, I don't think there is, because the quality and the character of that growth is going to change. And even as growth slows, the life of the family on the right there is a far more certain and comfortable than the life of the man on the left. One final thing to think about when we think about democracy. What is important is that people feel that they have a voice. I can say from personal experience of living in China, yes, you always felt it was difficult to be intellectually fully satisfied. It was difficult to go to a bookshop and find exactly what you wanted to buy. It was difficult to go to the cinema and watch a movie. You know, you might crave to see the latest Hollywood blockbuster, but you weren't going to see it. They're very strictly rationed. Some news out in the last couple of months saying that China was taking the first steps to liberalize the publishing houses. These publishing houses that used to churn out hundreds and hundreds of books on dense Marxist ideology that nobody bothered to read, not even the Chinese. They're now talking about selling them off to basically private businesses to run. So I think what you're going to see is Chinese living an intellectually far more stimulating life, and materialistically far more fulfilling one. I don't think this necessarily in and of itself causes demands for greater democracy. I would be surprised if we didn't, decades down the line, have a more democratic system that probably takes its cue from places like Taiwan or Korea that are successfully democratized. But I don't think it's a key thing in the minds of either the average family or in the minds of the government. So China, great power interrupted, I would say no, but great power on the way, not a power to be concerned about, but one that in 10, 20 years' time will look very familiar to us. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Dr. Horrocks. That was really interesting. I've got a few of the cards. If you have more questions as we turn over to our next speaker, go ahead and write them up. And let me switch out the slides here. Our next speaker is Dr. Aldous Cruz. He's assistant professor and former chair of the history department at the University of San Francisco. I think you just recently gave up the chairmanship. Congratulations.
It was peaceful. That's,
that's the way to do it. Get that out of the way. Professor Cruz's areas of specialization include contemporary Japanese politics, modern Chinese history, and U.S.-China and U.S.-Japan relations. He translated Kang Feng's An Economic History of the Major Capitalist Countries, and he's currently working on a book entitled A Biography of Shin Kanemura, The Rise and Fall of a Japanese Shadow Shogun. Please welcome Professor Cruz. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, too, Paul. I'd like to thank him and also Cynthia Miyashita for inviting me and creating this forum, this opportunity for me to talk about China and the impact of our great recession on China. I think what I'd like to do is go through this PowerPoint somewhat quickly and show you some of the ideas that I've developed as a result of thinking about some of the questions that Paul has included in the blurb describing the program today. I think, and here I won't go back as far as 100 years or 50 years. It feels a little shameful here. I'm the historian, but it's Robert who's done the historical work, so I have to really thank him for that. But surprisingly, and I think ironically, as I gave it some pause of thought, that this great recession over the last year, year and a half, has really brought the U.S. and China closer together. And what I mean China and the U.S. is at least the elites at the higher levels. And I think there are two major factors that are at work here. One is mutual interest. I think both sides want to avoid a financial and economic crisis or meltdown that would harm both of their interests, both of their material interests. And here we have to really talk about material interests. We have hard-headed realists who are in charge of both of these governments. Now, the other factor that is at work here is that because of that, some of the more contentious issues that you often read about in the press, the Taiwan issue for China, which has probably been the most sensitive issue over the last 30 or 40, and maybe even 60 years, and the human rights issue for the United States, which has been a crucial issue for the U.S. in the last 20 years, have been downplayed. They're not completely out of the picture. If you read Nancy Pelosi's op-ed piece in the Chronicle a few months ago, human rights has not been forgotten, but there are bigger fish to fry, and both the U.S. as well as China want to do that. So the one major result is there is greater dialogue and cooperation on a much broader range of issues, and I'll have a very detailed kind of timeline of very high-level back and forths over the last year. So there is a global warming, I think, and the fight against global warming, the way to really create this kind of green environment. Al Gore would love what's been happening here between the U.S. and China. And, of course, North Korea and nuclear nonproliferation. I think both sides want to see a non-nuclear Korea, both North as well as South. Now, I'd like to add, before I oversimplify the story here, and I've given you my answer really right off the bat rather than kind of sneaking up to it and giving it to you in the last 5 minutes, there are complications between the U.S. and China. And this is what I mean by caveats. Professors always have to complexify the situation. Sometimes things are very simple, but in reality, they're much more complicated. And right now, there's a very delicate minuet that's taking place between the U.S. and China. in this changing balance of power, both in a bilateral and regional sense, and how each country will adjust to that. I think quite clearly China is a rising economic power. It's also a rising military power. As America's power relatively to some of the other power centers declines, and here I'm talking of relative, although in an absolute sense America still maintains a preponderance of power both economically as well as militarily, how will the United States adjust to that? Will it see China as a threat? Will it see China as a partner? And so this is a very important element. Now, as economic ties grow, I think the focus then will become more on the friction, the economic friction, rather than issues like human rights or Taiwan independence, or even Xinjiang or Tibet or so on. There's going to be more issues that you'll be reading about regarding World Trade Organization. Will the United States permit the Chinese, for example, to buy a $41 billion corporation here in the United States? Maybe there isn't anything like that that's even worth that much anymore in the United States. But the Chinese just bought this huge Australian gas and oil field worth $41 billion. Will Americans be accommodating to something like that? So there are these, as the economic ties grow, the possibility of greater economic friction will also grow. This is one of Cruz's iron laws of history here. And I think as globalization occurs, each side will also have a greater impact on the other. Will this lead to greater calls for protectionism? Will Americans want the Chinese to revalue their currency so that we buy fewer Chinese goods? Will we buy American? Will they buy Chinese? So there are many unresolved issues for the future in terms of the economic arrangements as well as the power, the changing power relationships. So we have to keep that in mind. Let me just give you a very quick overview of the Great Recession. I think we've all lived through it, so I don't really need to spend too much time on this. But, of course, it begins in the U.S. financial sector, subprime loans going kaput. There's a bank bailout of many tens of billions of dollars. However, there's lack of lending, and so the financial crisis really spreads to manufacturing and other areas of the economy. Corporations cut back production. There's unemployment. 6 million people lose their jobs. Obama arrives with a stimulus package to try to stem the downturn in something like this. Now, this also has an impact on China. And we'll go through some of the specifics of this. The Chinese were watching this very, very carefully. Here is their biggest market, and it seems to be imploding. They're also holding $800 billion worth of bonds. Will they be safe? And so in the fall and winter of 2008, the Chinese political system and the political top political leadership probably were engaged in a very intense political conflict and debate over what to do. Should they, in effect, prop up this global system of capitalism? The Japanese are having a hard time, the Europeans. Or should they really be a responsible stakeholder? And the choice is they're going to be a responsible stakeholder. This is what they want to do. This is what they want to be. Now, could they have adopted any other approach? Partly, the U.S. holds $800 billion. The U.S. also is one of their major, major markets. And if you also watch all of this melt down in Japan, Europe, and the United States, there goes also your export-led engine of prosperity. So, in fact, it's probably in the best interests of the Communist Party, the top leaders, and also those people who are getting wealthy in China, to keep the system afloat. And so, basically, the outcome is the Chinese leadership decides to assist in the bailout of the United States, and they continue to buy U.S. bonds. They do offer some comments about how safe they are and some other areas to group other countries in terms of various kinds of financial packages to somewhat mitigate this reliance on the American dollar. Now, the Chinese political leadership also take economic measures that really very closely mirror that of the United States when you look at everything. One of the first things that happens is they offer a stimulus package. Obama would have been very, very happy, and in fact is, because what this meant was that the Chinese were not going to try to export their way out of this mess. They were actually going to try to stimulate domestic demand by pouring money into the economy, by creating jobs and, of course, creating infrastructure, roads, railways, housing, healthcare, education. It's a big package of, certainly it is. Monetary policy, easy money. If you want to buy that car, if you want to buy that house, this is the time to do it. And so the Chinese mirror the U.S. efforts very, very closely. It's remarkable how both the Chinese and American political leadership has followed pretty much the same path, a stimulus package for infrastructure and easy money. Now, the easy money is also leading to a bubble economy, maybe 30% inflated and things like that. So people are watching very carefully. In today's New York Times, stock market has gone down about 4% or 5%. Housing prices also are starting to be shaky. So that huge house that you might buy, is it really going to be worth that much a year from now or 2 years from now? So maybe all those folks want to buy the house and the car and so on. But will they actually be able to afford it? So this is a real calculus that's going on in the minds of people right now. So far, it's buy, buy, buy. Now, what other negative impacts have there been on China in terms of the American downturn? Unemployment. Now, in a country of 1.3 billion, probably 1.4 billion people, you can look at various kinds of sources, like The Economist or Japan Echo. They say, well, 20 million lose their jobs, 25 million. The U.S. loses 6, maybe 7 million. So no big deal, is it? Or is it a big deal? But quite clearly, the coastal industrial cities are hit hard with unemployment. Migrant workers are the first to be laid off. Trade is down. Foreign direct investment in China is down. Tough for high school and college grads to get jobs. And one of the other concerns of the Chinese leadership are the dollar bonds that they've paid for in China safe. Now, one thing that's also happened that's somewhat startling, despite maybe 20 or 25 million people being unemployed, the Chinese economy is still growing. If you look around the world, the Chinese economy, according to some estimates, would have grown about 6.5%. Right now, if you look at some of their pronouncements, they're going to grow 8% in the first half of the year. The luxury goods market is booming, that top 2% with maybe an income of around $36,000 to $40,000 a year. They're still buying those Gucci handbags. So China did buy bonds, but not as much in the way of stocks, so they don't take as serious a hit. And I didn't have time enough to really go through the Taiwan economic situation, but my impression is, judging from the people that I know from Taiwan, that Taiwan has been really hit hard by the U.S. By this U.S. recession. Now, I think another factor that really goes hand in hand with the economic crisis, this the Great Recession, is we have Mr. Obama, who comes into the picture in January. The recession occurs at the same time as we have a new Obama administration. And Obama has a new outlook on foreign policy. It's multilateral. It's not unilateral. He's looking for partnerships. And my gosh, there's China. Look and look. Changing priorities. George Bush, the war on terror. What does Mr. Obama want? Let's revive the U.S. economy. Let's get it out of Iraq, maybe expand the war in Afghanistan. But there's a new tone with the Obama administration. It's partnership, not competition, and it's multilateralism. And this really comes as great deal of soothing balm to the ears of the Chinese. Now, as a result of Obama's presidency, Obama's administration has really taken some very strong steps to build very strong ties with China, partly to smooth over the economic difficulties, but also to address some of these other issues, military issues. Is China growing to be a threat? Will China be a military threat in the future? What about issues like Darfur? What about issues like human rights? And so all of these really are factors that come into play. I've created a timeline here of this. The first visit is by Hillary Clinton, in February, just a month afterwards. It's tied in also with a visit to Indonesia and Japan and so on. But basically, Hillary Clinton brings this message of partnership and cooperation rather than confrontation or discussion of human rights. Hu Jintao meets with President Obama. This is the first summit meeting between the two top leaders, and they agree that they're going to elevate their discussions to cabinet level. They're going to have these major discussions in July that just happened about a month ago, and they're going to combine both economic as well as strategic and political issues. This is a major decision made by Obama as well as by Hu Jintao. A lot of this has kind of gone by the wayside in some ways. Nancy Pelosi visits China. What does she emphasize? Does she emphasize human rights? No. She emphasizes climate change, global warming. We've got to work together for that. We're not forgetting about human rights, but we have other things that we want to and must cooperate on. There is a special envoy that talks about Darfur. So in other words, there's a huge back and forth on these. Geithner visits China in May. Steinberg meets with Dai Bing-guo on North Korean issues. Very interesting visits by Locke and Chu to establish a clean energy research center. And this July 27th through the 30th, the first China-U.S. strategic and economic summit. Obama is present. What does he do? He throws out a basketball. He says, we've got to work together as a team. It's like, wow. And Obama uses language that I hadn't really seen since Mike Mansfield, when he was the ambassador to Japan, proclaimed the U.S.-Japan relationship the most important bilateral relationship in the world, bar none. Obama uses a different kind of language here. No other relationship is as important as that of the United States with China. So Japan gets downgraded. I think Tokyo was not really happy to hear that. It's not as bad as Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton in Foreign Affairs wrote that the U.S. relationship with China is the most important. So there must have been a great deal of back and forth in the State Department and also with Obama on this. Now, Robert, I think, talked a little bit about the importance of the 2009, so maybe I should just go over this somewhat more quickly. One of the things that I noticed about the 60th anniversary, the 60 years is a complete cycle in traditional thinking, where you have all the stems and the branches all finally coming to a conclusion at the end of 60 years. So you really take stock after 60 years. 60 years is the magic moment. It's not 50 or 100 in terms of our calculations or reckoning. And I did a quick survey of some of the websites for the Chinese newspapers, and it was remarkable how little there was in terms of this event. We're putting a lot more attention on it than the Chinese are. There's a big photo display in Wangfujing. It's like, that's all? No marching bands? What? So there isn't much triumphalism. I'm probably stretching it a little bit to call this the 30th anniversary of the Deng reforms, but in some ways, I very much agree with Robert that finally China is getting it right. They're kind of going in the right direction in so many ways, both politically, economically, socially. But also the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen. And so basically China has still maintained this authoritarian political system, and you can see how it reacts to any kind of resistance in Tibet and Xinjiang. It also represses human rights activists. I think all of you know this. So it's still very much an authoritarian system. Well, let's talk about the Communist Party and the issue of democracy. And I think we may be getting close to 5 minutes, but what I'd like to do is The Chinese Communist Party does have these debates. Now, I don't know how real they are, but quite clearly I think there are differences of viewpoint on this. And democracy has been a political touch point for the Chinese political elite since Sun Yat-sen. Sun Yat-sen made democracy one of the three people's principles. Mao even talked about the people's democratic dictatorship. So you always have to bring democracy into this. And you do have reformers within the Chinese political system. I think people like Wen Jiabao, who's gone on record saying that, in fact, things like science, democracy, human rights are the common values of civilization. Wu Bangguo was also a very high-ranking member of the Chinese Communist Party, the head of the National People's Congress, or China's parliament, basically says, none of this. Forget this. This isn't going to happen. There have been some efforts at low-level democracy through beginning really in the 1980s, and the Chinese Communist Party tried to reestablish its legitimacy through various low-level village elections. This was kind of Chinese democracy Chinese style, or with Chinese characteristics. The Carter Center in Atlanta has been probably the most active in monitoring the various efforts at local level elections and things like that. And the idea is basically to change this Chinese traditional political culture, which really sees obedience to authority figures as one of the key elements here. There have been a lot of scholarly debates over how effective these new elements are of elections. It goes in various kinds of ways. In other words, some cases in certain villages, the Communist Party members basically control everything and the elections are a sham. In other cases, the elections become feuds. People get killed over who's going to stand for election and so on. So you lift the lid on some of these democratic measures and it's not going to be pretty. My own feeling here is that the level of democracy that's tolerated by the Communist Party is really to gain greater legitimacy for the Communist Party itself. The reforms will continue. If you look at 2009, Hu Jintao, who's president, also the secretary general of the Chinese Communist Party, has affirmed the importance of the reforms. So you're going to continue to see change. There's going to be more, both political and economic. The three don'ts: don't waver, don't slacken, don't get sidetracked. But all those reforms are going to be piecemeal and incremental. And it's pretty much the same kind of features, the same kind of language that Deng Xiaoping used even after 1989, after the suppression of the democracy movement there. Good. I've got four more minutes. So how should the U.S. balance its economic and security interests with its concerns for human rights in China? Nancy Pelosi has probably been the leading spokeswoman for the idea of human rights in China. She was one of the leaders after 1989 and so on. And human rights this isn't just Nancy Pelosi. Human rights has been a central feature of U.S. foreign policy since the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt in the creation of the United Nations and the first United Nations Charter on Human Rights. And certainly Jimmy Carter did a lot to do this too. But can the U.S. impose human rights on China? Ed Friedman, who is not soft on China at all, but a leading scholar, feels that our best hope is really not so much to lecture China or to berate China about its human rights lapses or its authoritarianism, but it's for us to demonstrate our own robust democracy and human rights in the United States. The U.S. should serve as a model rather than as a stern taskmaster. What recommendations do I have for U.S. policymakers? I think engagement. I'm a panda hugger. Those are where we get labeled, you know, the softies or the panda huggers. So I'm a panda hugger. I think engagement is better. And the world's problems as well as the U.S. problems must be solved in tandem with China. China's simply too big to ignore. Richard Nixon recognized this in 1971 and 1972. And so this isn't really saying very much in a way. It's a platitude, but it's really true. So we've got to really work our way out of this with China in terms of the economics and political situation. One thing that I think also is very important for us to consider is that China really has, or most of the Chinese that I know, have a vast reservoir of good feelings towards the United States. The very name U.S. is Meigwa, which means beautiful country. The elite send their children to the United States to study. I was hosting a young student who was on her way to Baylor. Her greatest interest was, what did you do on your prom? They want to know what I did on my prom. I could barely remember myself, but I just got an email from her. My gosh, Baylor has two bears as mascots on the campus. Do American universities have bears on their campus? So there's great interest and curiosity, and of course she comes from a very elite family. Obama also gets high marks. This isn't just simply a random sample of people, but he gets about 70% approval ratings in China, which are higher here than he should run in China. He should learn some Chinese and so on. So U.S. soft power has great influence in China. We don't really need to lecture them. We just need to send them some bears from Baylor and send them pictures of our proms. And, you know, soft power really goes a long, long, long way. And so those are my comments. I've tried to cover a fair amount here. Basically, this economic crisis over the last year, year and a half, has really brought, I think, the U.S. and China closer together, partly out of shared necessity, the economic necessities of really having to live together where we consume and the Chinese produce, although some of those adjustments will also have to be made. And then also this new Obama administration that wants to see multilateralism and partnership in so many areas, not just in China, but also on health care reform and so on. Bilateralism and multilateralism is the key word. So those are my two key themes and my two key answers. Thank you very much for coming and listening.
Oh, great. Thank you, Dr. Cruz. I have quite a few questions, and I'm going to start off with one for Dr. Horrocks. And we just saw the stat, 8% growth. The question is, why is this happening? Is this sustainable? Is this the stimulus package that China's done, or why are they doing that, and why is the rest of the world not?
Okay. When it comes to growth in China, a lot of people have the impression that... Actually, I'm going to stand up. I think a lot of people have the impression that somehow China exported to grow. China exported to develop expertise. If you even during the last 10, 15 years, when exports went from 0% to 10% of GDP and China was growing at 11% overall, exports probably accounted for about 2% of that 11%. China has the ability internally to grow over that period at rates of 7, 8, 9%. Why? The way you grow is increased productivity, better skills, more machines to work with, more educated workforce, better roads that you can transport the goods, efficiencies. This is what generates growth. That's what will generate growth in China in the future. Now, maybe you lose that 2% that was exporting to a U.S. consumer who was up to their eyeballs in debt. What you replace that with is your own domestic consumption. We're actually seeing this in a lot of the companies that we visit on our research trips. Companies that used to, I don't know, make shoes and sell them, you know, for Nike, they're now turning around and saying, well, I can make a cheap shoe and I can sell it into the second or third tier cities where people will pay not $100 but maybe $10 or $15 for a shoe. And that's where the growth is coming from. So, you know, it's almost as if, you know, the world as a whole couldn't grow unless it exported to Mars. The same sort of way of thinking applies to China. China doesn't need an export market to grow.
And Dr. Cruz, I got a softball for you.
Oh.
Not really, no.
Sure.
Actually, there's a microphone if you want to stay with your... Give it a test, see if it works there. There we are.
Is this on?
It is.
On good.
The potential of a democracy in China and what that implies for the more embattled minorities, the Tibetans and the Uyghurs. So it's a double-edged question there. Maybe you could address both those topics.
Well, that, of course, has been a major issue for China for 100 years. As I mentioned, democracy was on the lips of Sun Yat-sen. This was one of his goals. He was also a realist and a pragmatist and said the Chinese were not ready for this. So he wanted a guided democracy by people who presumably knew better than the average person. So democracy has had a long history and a long pedigree. A lot depends on what you mean by democracy. Democracy can mean so many different things to so many different people. And I don't want to sound like Bill Clinton here. It's like, what part of is. But democracy is a very complicated kind of concept. My own impression of what most of the people that I know who I speak to in China, and there tend to be urban dwellers, relatively well-to-do, relatively affluent, people who are scholars, intellectuals, and so on, they want the right to express themselves, free speech, the right to get access to materials. You know, if I want to look at Facebook or, you know, Twitter or, you know, things of this sort. So a lot of it has to do with sources, free access to information and sources, and the freedom to speak your mind. One of the most chilling features was I went to the Song Qingling Museum. Now, Song Qingling was the widow of Sun Yat-sen. She was Mrs. China in a way. And so in the hall, there were many pictures of Song Qingling. But the person I was with, who was a Chinese woman from the National Archives, made sure that whenever she made any comments about Song Qingling, which were not encrusted in the signage, there was no one else around. She really couldn't speak her mind. It was really a shame. And the same was true of another professor who I knew. We went into a bookstore. We looked at various kinds of books. This person really was hedging her comments. So I think the idea of being able to speak your mind, perhaps being critical, I think these are parts of democracy, intellectual democracy. I think we mostly think of it as elections. And certainly that's part of it. That's the more dangerous part for the Chinese Communist Party. There you get into the area of maybe losing power. They're toying with this idea at the local levels through these elections, and there are elections within the Communist Party itself. The Communist Party is huge. It's over 60 million people, so that's like the country of France. So you do get elections at various levels, but it's all kind of cut off at various points. So I think eventually there will be democracy. I think clearly, if you look at the historical record, people want that, the freedom to speak out, the freedom to hold elections. And so I think what will happen is the Communist Party will give way on this on an incremental and gradual basis. They don't want a complete loss of power instantly. And I think most people don't want to see the kind of chaos that might result from the implosion of the Communist Party. So they are also looking for some kind of stability. So often they don't push as hard as one might think. At least that's been my experience with it. Now, what about Xinjiang and Tibet and so on? Part of these are issues that have to deal with national minorities. These are issues that deal with ethnic rights, and where much of the problem, I think, stems from the fact that because of the prosperity of the overall Han Chinese people, which is the largest group, maybe 94, 92% of the population, they're going into these areas and becoming a bit like carpetbaggers. They set up shops. They become the very successful entrepreneurs. It's a little bit like the Koreans moving into South Central Los Angeles. And so after Rodney King, what happened? A lot of the Korean places got trashed. And so on. So part of this is this kind of resentment against the economic entrepreneurialism and the successful economic entrepreneurialism of the Han Chinese. In other cases, it also has to do with religious discrimination. The Chinese themselves are, the Communist Party is avowedly atheistic. And so so they're, you know, they're respectful of religion in a formal way, but in informal, I think the message is quite clear. So I think both the Xinjiang, the Muslims, the Uyghurs, as well as the Tibetans feel like they are a threatened minority and a threatened ethnic minority. And so this is why you get these kinds of outbursts, and I think you'll have more. I think you'll see more of this.
Dr. Horrocks, why are the Chinese still buying U.S. treasuries? What does that imply for the U.S. economically, and when will it stop? Why will it stop?
I guess they're buying U.S. treasuries at the moment because partly, as Uldis pointed out, they want to be helpful. Partly because they don't have much choice in the matter. What else are you going to buy? I guess you could buy UK debt, but that's probably looking even worse than US debt at the moment. So, and partly because the way you get out of this ultimately is you stimulate consumption in China. That takes time to build the welfare system I spoke of. It takes time to build capital markets. They've gone a long way of the way, but you have equities in China, you have bank debt, you don't have a lot of corporate bonds. They're going to build that system. What they need to do is they need to be able to circulate more of these savings internally within their own system to become less dependent upon the US dollar. Now, at that point, the Chinese currency probably also becomes more convertible. It has flourishing capital markets. Maybe, you know, play this little intellectual game, if you will. So 20 years from now, the U.S. has a massive current account surplus with China. China has a current account deficit. People in the U.S. are saving hand over fist. In China, they've got a subprime mortgage problem in Shanghai. And everybody has, you know, 12 credit cards in their wallet. It doesn't have to go that far, and hopefully it won't go that far, but, you know, hopefully it'll meet somewhere in between. But it's going to take a little while before all the institutions are fully built in China. For the meantime, they'll continue to buy treasuries, I guess.
Dr. Cruz, what about the Chinese military buildup? You know, it's been, you know, 2 decades now of double-digit growth every year in their budget, starting from a very low base, obviously. What does that imply for the region and for the U.S.?
It's always dangerous to put me in front of a microphone because I'll talk forever. But I'll try to keep my comment somewhat brief. The Chinese military has been modernizing, and it's certainly no longer the kind of military that it was under Mao's days with millet and rifles and things like this. I think the New York Times carried an article just yesterday or today that the budget is around $70 billion. The U.S. budget for the military is around $700 billion. So the U.S. outspends the Chinese military by a factor of about 10 to 1. So most of the strategic thinking or the doctrine that guides this military is no longer the theory of people's war or world revolution, but it's really very defensive. It's a very defensive kind of doctrine. So I don't really see much in the way of a threat from China. I don't see that military threat. David Shambaugh, who is probably one of our leading experts on China as a whole, he used to be the editor of the China Quarterly, very knowledgeable man, wrote a number of books on the Chinese military. And his most recent comments were that China was really about 10 years behind the United States in terms of a lot of its capabilities and so on. And that people really should not be that worried about it. Most of this is focused really on a defensive posture. So that would be an answer, too.
Okay, great. I'm going to give one more question for each of the speakers. And Dr. Horrocks, we hear a lot about the great news economically out of China, particularly things that are happening on the coast. But you also can find that there's literally, according to tracking, there's tens of thousands of protests, labor protests throughout the country, demonstrations. What is your take on what is the attitude of labor towards the government, towards the economy, maybe that they're not participating in fully? You know, is this a potential for a solidarity type of movement that would, you know, lead from the bottom up?
I think most of the unrest that you hear about, the so-called labor unrest, is around local issues. And it's normally to do with appropriation of land or workplace issues. I'll give you an example. I have a very good friend who speaks the best Chinese of a Westerner that I've ever come across, which is kind of strange because he's from Northern Ireland and he's got a very thick Irish accent. But he works as a security expert outside these big chemical plants. They build the security teams. They look after the integrity of the plant. And he came across a bizarre situation where all of a sudden the plant and the officers that house the management of the plant were besieged by the workers and their family members from a local village. The bizarre situation that the women at one gate were throwing their children over the gate, so the security guards rushed to catch these children as they were being launched over the side. Meanwhile, the men were coming in over the back. It was, you know, and it was all actually a spontaneous village-based outcry against. I think one family member had been severely injured on his way home from work, and they wanted the plant to pay for the healthcare for this guy. So, I mean, I don't want to take too much from an anecdote, but a lot of what you hear about this unrest is very local scale. It'll have some very small reason like that behind it. There isn't a lot of organized labor left in China, to be honest. My historical studies was on the labor movement in the 20s, and part of that studies, this is way back in 1991, I think I spent 6 months in Guangdong, researching at the trade union archives, and the only thing that the heads of the trade union wanted to know from me was what was my view on the oil price. There really isn't organized labor in any large scale way in China. So I don't see the opportunity for a solidarity type movement to start up. Where does it organize? How do you finance yourself? Unless there's going to be a massive split within the upper levels of the Communist Party that would want to back this, but I just don't see that faction appearing.
If I could follow up, so when you talk about local issues, is corruption quite often the issue?
Corruption is a big issue. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's probably got a lot better than it used to be, but I know people who used to invest in China. You know, if they wanted to build a hotel or something, you put 10-15% of the costs aside just to pay off the local governments. I'd be surprised if it wasn't still there, but you know, maybe competition has brought that price down a bit. I mean, one thing you've got to realize is you think the U.S. is a free market society. You live in China, and you realize there's a price for everything, and there's competition is fierce to a degree that you wouldn't believe.
Mm-hmm. Great. And Dr. Cruz, speaking about competition, what about the competition between the U.S. and China for resources, leading to such anomalies as the Chinese support for the Sudan government?
Yes. Well, it's a good question. I think as China grows, it also doesn't have the range of resources, petroleum, bauxite, and things like this. So just most recently, the example I gave you was they bought from an Australian company something like a $41 billion purchase of gas and oil over the next 10 or 20 years. These are massive, massive purchases. So there's been a lot of attention paid to this scramble for resources, whether it's oil or gas or various other things, iron ore and things like that. As China modernizes, of course, it's going to need more of these sinews of industrialization. So, yes, I think it's going to bid up the price of virtually everything. I think the example that I heard was 3 or 4 years ago, the price of the cost of building the Bay Bridge increased by $1 to $2 to $3 billion because the steel had been grabbed up by the Chinese. And so Americans had to pay more to build this structure. So as China becomes a major power, you know, it's either whether you look at it in terms of absolute equivalent, the third largest economy or fifth largest economy, whichever measure you want to use, as people become more affluent, they're going to demand more of the things that we consider to be what we like, and we're going to have to pay more for it. We have folks out there who want the same things we do. Whether it's steel or Baylor University or whatever.
Another little intellectual game I like to play on this topic is the urbanization rate of China over the last 20 years is equivalent to adding the population of Philadelphia every month. Mm-hmm. Every month. And so they will continue to consume steel and cement and coal and other resources.
If I could just add to that, I think this is where we see the kind of changing power relationships. I think we've in some ways assumed China has been the China of 50 years ago or 100 years ago or so on. But in China's rise, it has a lot of ripple effects. And it's not just about the military. It's also about factors like the Chinese are becoming major players. Now, Gucci loves it. Baylor University loves it. After, you know, they're paying good tuition dollars for this experience. So, but in other cases, it may gore our ox. So the Chinese are real players, and we need to negotiate with them in this new arena.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank our two speakers, Dr. Aldous Cruz from San Francisco, University of San Francisco, and Dr. Robert Horrocks from Matthews International. I'd also like to thank you, the audience, and our co-sponsor, the Truman National Security Project. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. Yeah.